Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say the menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac killer. Betsy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Names like Dahmer, Bundy, Gacy, Warnos conjure up images of heinous acts that one human can do to another. What causes one person to commit these acts? How do serial killers operate? How do they select their victims? Are there predisposing factors? Today on Crime and Forensics, we will attempt to answer these questions and others. Welcome to Crime and Forensics. I am your show host, Stephen David Lampley. Because of the information that I want to get out today, we're going to skip the trivia and the shout-out sections in order to give us more time to cover the material. Before we begin, however, let's do some background stuff. Let's talk about what is a serial killer. Well, that depends on who you listen to. It depends on who you ask and who you read. But basically, however, a serial killer is a person who commits at least three murders over a period of more than a month and has a cooling off period between the murders. Now, a serial killer is not the same as a spree killer. A spree killer is a person who kills two or more people in a short period of time in multiple locations, and there is a lack of a cooling off period. And that's what marks the difference between a serial killer and a spree killer, is the cooling off period. All right, now before we get into the information, let's also dispel a variety of false assumptions that a lot of people have regarding serial killers. The first misconception is that serial killers are all dysfunctional loners, and that is not true. In fact, most serial killers are not reclusive loners at all. Now, there are some who are. Some serial killers are right out in plain sight. John Wayne Gacy, for instance, was a prominent member of his community. He owned his own business, he was a clown at parties, and he was even a guest at the White House. Now, a second misconception regarding serial killers is that they are all white males. Again, not true. Now, there are white, black, Asian, Hispanic serial killers. Actually, in the United States, the overall serial killer population, and this comes from Radford University, the percentages are as follows: white 51.7, black 39.8, Hispanic 6.7%, Asian 0.9%, and Native American 1.0%. Now, the third myth, the only motivation for serial killers is sex. False. There are various motivations and different reasons for serial killers to kill, and not just sex. And we will discuss motivation more in depth here shortly. Another myth is that all serial killers travel from state to state. Again, false. In fact, most serial killers have a particular area of operation. Most times a serial killer they'll commit their crimes within a certain comfort zone, an area they are familiar with and comfortable operating within. Now, sometimes serial killers may expand outside their comfort zone, but usually only after they're comfortable and their confidence has grown. Now, there's a misconception that once serial killers begin killing, they cannot stop. That is not true. One example of this is the BTK killer, Dennis Rader. Now, he killed his last victim in 1991 and did not kill again prior to being arrested in 2005. Another misconception is that all serial killers are either evil, geniuses, or profoundly insane. That is not true. Some serial killers, yes, are highly intelligent, but there are some who fall far below the average intelligence level, while the preponderance of serial killers are close to the societal norm in intelligence. In fact, the average IQ of known serial killers is 94.5. Now, most serial killers are not adjudicated as insane. Some, however, are psychopathic, psychotic, or possess other personality disorders. Some think that all serial killers are men. Again, not the case. While most are men, there are many cases of female serial killers. So what are serial killers if all those characteristics are false? Well, let's find out. All right, now depending on who you read and what study you go by, classifying serial killers can be as diverse as those doing the studies. In one study, serial killers are classified as organized, disorganized, and mixed. Another study classifies them according to their motives, while the symposium sponsored by the FBI on August 29th of 2005, a group of 135 of the world's leading experts from multi-disciplines determined that, quote, there is no generic template for a serial killer, unquote, and there are no special combinations of traits or characteristics shown to differentiate serial killers from other violent offenders, unquote. Additionally, they stated, there is no single identifiable cause or factor that leads to the development of a serial killer. Now, given these comments, the symposium attendees did list some common traits among serial killers. One of those traits is they have a leaning and propensity to violent behavior. A second trait is a disregard for local, state, and federal laws. 3, a disregard for societal morals and standards. 4, an uncaring regard for the rights of other individuals. 5, a void of remorse or guilt for their actions. 6, a need for control over their victims. And 7, a need for sensation seeking. Now, as related to the classification of serial killers into organized and disorganized, what then is a disorganized serial killer? Well, according to this classification, disorganized serial killers are spontaneous. They act without planning. Their victims are usually known to them, and there is little conversation with their victims prior to their murder. The crime scenes are usually sloppy, with the weapon and victim's body still on the scene. Now, because the attack of their victims is sudden, there is no need for any restraints to hold their victims, and there typically are no restraints found on the scene. As a person, a disorganized serial killer probably lives alone, lives and works near the crime scene. They have below average intelligence. They're usually an unskilled worker. Their father's work was also unstable. The disorganized serial killer usually had harsh discipline as a child and typically socially and sexually incompetent. After each murder, there is a significant behavioral change in the offender. Now, opposite the disorganized serial killer in the trichotomy is the organized serial killer. The organized serial killer plans the murder sometimes for a long, long time. Their victim is usually a stranger that they meet as they seek a particular type of victim. They're looking for somebody that meets what they're looking for, meets the fantasy, meets the object of their desire. The organized serial killer engages their prey in conversation but maintains control of that conversation. The crime scene of the organized serial killer typically reflects the control as well and usually has restraints on the scene that they use to hold their victim. An organized serial killer will typically remove the weapon and transport the body to another location after the murder. As a person, the organized serial killer usually has average to above average intelligence and is probably employed in a skilled trade or professional employment. The employment of the organized serial killer's father is typically stable. The organized serial killer probably had inconsistent discipline as a child and is both socially and sexually competent and is probably living with someone, possibly a partner or spouse. Often their need to murder is precipitated by situational stress. Now, unlike the disorganized serial killer, the organized serial killer probably has reliable transportation. All right, this is going to be a good spot for us to take a quick break, and we will come right back and get right back into this.
Lied to, right? It's not if you're lied to, it's do you know when it happens? Studies show that the average person can only catch a lie about 54% of the time. Heck, you might as well just flip a coin. But studies also show that a person who has been properly trained in lie detection can detect lies about 90% of the time. A big difference. Stephen presented his How to Catch a Liar session at the 2018 Crime Con at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center and had to be moved from the Washington Conference Room into the Presidential Ballroom due to the enormous number of registrations to hear his program. Even in the Presidential Ballroom, it was standing room only with 850 people seated. You can have this session brought to your company or organization. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for more information.
Welcome back. Let's go ahead and skip over and discuss motives. Broadly, serial killer motives are categorized as 1. Power and control, 2. Mission-oriented, 3. Visionary, and 4. Hedonistic. Now, as a motive of the power and control serial killer, this serial killer wishes to exert their dominance over their victim. Often a power and control motivated serial killer was abused as a child, and this has left them with feelings of internal inadequacy and powerlessness in their adult lives. Now they have power as they commit their murders. It should be noted that it is very common that the power and control motivated serial killer often abuse their victims sexually, but this is not the primary focus, but is simply another avenue by which they exert control over their victim. The next, mission-motivated serial killers seek to perform some quote-unquote grand act, if you will, perhaps make the world a better place in their opinion. An example of a mission-oriented serial killer might be to kill all prostitutes, or perhaps all people from one religion or a lifestyle belief. They envision themselves as curing society in some way. The third motive type for serial killers is the visionary. Now, visionary serial killers are frequently psychotic. Now, being psychotic, they believe they are acting upon or acting under the direction from another power, such as a god or from Satan. However, the order to kill can also come from animals or inanimate objects as well. The fourth motivation type is that of hedonistic. Now, there are classifications of hedonistic motivated serial killers, and there are three of those. The first is profit. In this category, victims are frequently family members, and their motivation is to simply profit from the family member's death. Inheritance, life insurance, those are frequently the desires. The second type of hedonistic serial killer is that of a thrill. As a thrill killer, this serial killer seeks to induce pain and terror on his victims, and he experiences an adrenaline rush during the hunting and eventual killing of the victim. Now, thrill killers only kill for the excitement and the thrill. Typically, there is no sexual desire, and most thrill killers desire to commit the perfect crime, and most of them believe they will not get caught. The Zodiac killer, for instance, fits in this category. The third type of hedonistic motivated serial killer is that of a lust killer. As a lust killer, sex is the main purpose, usually to the degree that they inflict pain, mutilation, and torture relates to the degree of their sexual gratification. The weapons of choice of a lust killer are weapons that require them to be close to their victims, such as a knife. With a lust killer, they must increase the frequency of their kills or increase the degree of mutilation and pain or both. Now, Jeffrey Dahmer fits into this particular category. All right, what does a serial killer experience in the process of killing? All right, in 1988, psychologist Joel Norris identified 7 phases that serial killers experience. The first phase is what we call the aura phase. Now, during the aura phase, the serial killer begins to withdraw from reality. He or she, they'll begin to distance themselves from people and from interactions socially. Although distancing themselves, most people, even family and friends, may not notice this distancing. The serial killer is in a sort of despair state, and life generally has no meaning. Now, depending on the serial killer, this phase can last from a few seconds or for a number of months. It usually begins as a prolonged fantasy, and that fantasy may have itself been present for a number of years. The urges often involve violent and sadistic sexual acts. Now, after a period of time, the serial killer must act on these urges. The trolling phase is next, and it is during this phase that the serial killer attempts to find a victim. As we mentioned earlier, most serial killers act in an area in their comfort zone, and this is where the serial killer will attempt to locate their victim. While trolling for a victim, they will also scope out a location to commit the murder and, depending on the type of serial killer, a location to dump the body. Now, this can continue for several months until a suitable situation can be found. Now, once a potential victim is located, the third phase, the wooing phase, then begins. And this typically only is utilized by the organized serial killer if you're looking into that type of categorization. Once a potential victim is located, the third phase, the wooing phase, then begins. Now, this phase is typically only utilized by the organized serial killer if you're using that categorization of serial killer. As the name implies, it is in this phase that the serial killer attempts to gain the trust of the target. The organized serial killer typically has good interpersonal skills. Usually only the victims that they have gained the trust of will be the ones that they pick as their victims. Once the serial killer has the victim at the selected crime scene, the serial killer's facade erodes and the real person is revealed. Now, when that happens, it leads into the capture phase. In the capture phase, the serial killer now has control of the victim, and the victim cannot escape. This is a relished moment for the serial killer. Now, once the victim is subdued and unable to escape, the next phase begins, the murder phase. Now, depending on the desires of the serial killer, he may elect to kill his victim quickly or may decide to murder the victims slowly, inflicting heinous pain and torture on them over a period of time. There are instances where the serial killer will torture the victim to the brink of death. but allow them to live, then bring them back, and then repeat the pain and torturous acts all over again. Now, using the organized, disorganized, and mixed trichotomy of serial killer classification, a disorganized serial killer will typically kill their victim quickly, and it is probable that the victim will be depersonalized and have facial and other bodily mutilations. The disorganized killer who wants sex from the victim can be obtained after the victim is dead. The organized killer in this trichotomy usually enjoys inflicting pain and goes more slowly. Any sex from the victim is typically done prior to death of the victim. Now, after the organized killer has completed his pain and torture of the victim, he can then proceed to the kill. This leads to the totem phase. During this phase, the thrill and excitement of the kill is now gone, the victim's dead, and the serial killer snaps out of this fantasy land and falls into a depressive state. To help combat this depression, some serial killers will collect souvenirs from the victim, and these souvenirs can consist of a wide variety of things: jewelry, clothing, photos they take of the deceased victim, or even body parts of the victim. Now, these souvenirs are taken in hopes that the serial killer can relive the experience of the murder. The final phase is the depression phase. After the murder is complete, the serial killer can experience a significant depression and emotional dump. A serial killer who has killed because he needed to release pent-up feelings from an unhappy or abusive childhood finds that after the killing of the victim, these pent-up feelings still remain and the killing brought no permanent relief. Unfortunately, the fantasies will return and the serial killer will fall back into phase one, the aura phase, and begin the process all over again. Now, this cycle can continue over and over until the serial killer is caught or stops. In some instances, the serial killer becomes tired of the killing and realizing that the murders are not releasing the internal issues he harbors mentally, he may resort to suicide. Okay, I hope you were able to take something away from this episode. Feel free to share this show with your true crime friends. Coming up next is our Unsolved segment. Until next time.
Lied to, right? It's not if you're lied to, it's do you know when it happens? Studies show that the average person can only catch a lie about 54% of the time. Heck, you might as well just flip a coin. But studies also show that a person who has been properly trained in lie detection can detect lies about 90% of the time. A big difference. Stephen presented his How to Catch a Liar session at the 2018 Crime Con at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center and had to be moved from the Washington Conference Room into the Presidential Ballroom due to the enormous number of registrations to hear his program. Even in the Presidential Ballroom, it was standing room only with 850 people seated. You can have this session brought to your company or organization. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for more information.
Fox Chase area of Philadelphia is approximately 10 miles northwest of the heart of downtown. In 1957, this area was a rural location consisting mostly of woods and farmland. Susquehanna Road was a half-mile country road that linked Pine Road to the west and Verree Road to the east. There were no houses on Susquehanna Road at that time. The trees that ran along the road did not extend but a few yards in any direction. Susquehanna Road is approximately 4 miles northeast of the Delaware River and the New Jersey state line. There was a misting rain that Monday with a slight breeze and the temperature was in the low 50s. A college student, Frederick Benoit, attending LaSalle, was walking through the tree line along the northwest corner of Susquehanna Road in an attempt to reach the Good Shepherd Home, a Catholic home for, quote, wayward girls. What he discovered, however, was not the sights he had hoped to see in the windows of the girls' home. Although a dumping ground for the locals, there was garbage and rusting appliances, but what he discovered changed his plans and he quickly left the area. Frederick came across a cardboard box lying on its side, a shipping box for a bassinet measuring approximately 19 inches by 18 inches in the opening and 35 inches deep, with the word fragile printed on the box. The top of the box was opened, and sticking out of the box was what he thought was a doll. Scared, Frederick did not go to the police, but he did, however, tell his priest, who instructed him to go to the police and report what he saw. He did this the next day. Patrol officer Elmer Palmer responded to the scene and walked the short dirt path to where the box was located. As he approached the box opening, he observed what appeared to be a young boy. One of the boy's shoulders was also partially out of the box. The remainder of the lifeless body was wrapped in a cheap and faded cotton flannel blanket cut into two unequal pieces, with a plaid design of diamonds and blocks, and colors of white, rust, green, and brown. The blanket had been repaired with poor quality cotton thread, apparently with a home sewing machine. The boy was dry, but his right hand and both feet were wrinkled as if the boy had been in water just before or sometime after his death. His arms were neatly folded across his abdomen. The boy's fingernails and toenails had been neatly trimmed. His eyes were slightly open, as if he was just waking from sleep. The young boy appeared to be around 4 to 6 years of age. He had blue eyes, medium brown hair that had been chopped off in chunks, and the clumps of hair clung to his body. He was fair-complected. The boy was 40 inches in length and weighed 30 pounds. It appeared as though his eyebrows had been styled as if a female would do hers. His lips were crusted with blood, and in his throat was a brownish substance, appearing that he may have vomited prior to his death. He possessed a full set of baby teeth. The boy was extremely malnourished and had not eaten in 2 to 3 days prior to his death. There were no vaccination scars, indicating he had never attended public school. Due to external conditions, it is unsure if the boy had been there for 2 days or 3 weeks. The boy was nude except for what cover was made by the blanket in which he was wrapped. During the investigation, it was discovered that the box was originally a box containing a new bassinet that was sold by the J.C. Penney Company. That particular bassinet was sold by the Upper Darby J.C. Penney store sometime between December 3, 1956 and February 16, 1957. It was one of 12 sold by that store at a price of $7.50. All bassinets were tracked back to their original owners, except for one. An expanded search of the area yielded a blue corduroy cap with a label of the Robbins Eagle Hat and Cap Company in Philadelphia. In speaking with the owner, Hannah Robbins, they learned that the cap was one of 12 caps that had been made from remnants. These caps were made prior to May of 1956. This cap, however, was made without a leather strap, and the purchaser, a blonde-haired male, returned to have the strap sewn on the cap. After the police detective showed Hannah the photo of the deceased boy's face, she told him that the male resembled the boy. Unfortunately, she had no record of the purchaser's address. Police canvassed neighborhoods and checked every orphanage and hospital in the area, and all children were accounted for. Philadelphia police gave out over 10,000 flyers that had the boy's picture on them. The Philadelphia Gas Company mailed out approximately 200,000 flyers to their customers. No response. The case went cold, and the boy in the box was buried in a potter's field near the state hospital in Philadelphia. The boy stayed buried until November 4, 1988, and he was exhumed and DNA was extracted for future use and potential comparisons of possible suspects. On November 11, 1988, the boy in the box was reburied in a donated coffin in Ivy Hill Cemetery. Yes, this case is old, very old, but we really need to solve this one. The boy in the box deserves it. Do you have any information about who this innocent young victim is or who could be so heinous to have committed such a callous act? If you do, please come forward. Contact the Philadelphia Police Department at area code 215-686-TIPS, 215-686-8477. Thank you. Hello, welcome back to Crime and Forensics. I am your show host, Stephen David Lampley. Have you ever wanted to really, truly understand DNA? Well, hopefully today on Crime and Forensics, we will be able to help you understand DNA, what it's made of, how it's put together, how it replicates, where it's found, what it does, and we'll even discuss how DNA evidence works. All right, grab a pen, get some paper, and let's do this. Deoxyribonucleic acid. DNA is an acid? It is an acid. DNA is an acid because of the acidic nature of the phosphate group that is attached. The acidic part of the molecule dominates, which means that DNA is an acid. All right, now DNA is sourced half from our mothers and half from our fathers, and it contains the codes of all of the information our cells need to reproduce. Most DNA now is located in the nucleus of a cell and therefore is called nuclear DNA. But some of the DNA is located in the mitochondria. Now, a mitochondria is the organelle where the process of respiration and energy production occur within the cell. The mitochondria are structures inside the cells, and they convert food into energy that the cells can use. Now, it's the DNA that tells the cells what to do, a lot like your boss at work may tell you what to do. There are approximately 37 trillion cells in our body. So there's a whole lot of bossing going on there. DNA looks like a ladder, but it's twisted. It's like taking a ladder and twisting it from top to bottom. It's a spiraling ladder of sorts. Now, this spiraling ladder is what we refer to as a double helix. Okay, Stephen, what the heck is a helix? All right, a helix is a spiraling curve in a three-dimensional space. In other words, really simplified, if you were to wrap a wire around a paper towel tube from top to bottom and then take away the tube, you would be left with a wire in a circular pattern in a 3D model. And a double helix is similar to that, except it's twisted side by side and there's two of them. Now, these two helixes are held together by the rungs or the steps on the ladder. Okay, so let's get into just exactly what DNA is composed of. As I said, DNA is shaped like a twisted ladder. The sides of the ladder, or the helixes, in this case, of DNA, are made up of sugar and phosphates. The sugar and phosphate segments on the helix alternate. Sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate. The helixes of the DNA run opposite of each other. In other words, if you were to take the ladder as the example from a second ago, one helix would run from the top to the bottom, and the helix on the other side would run just the opposite. It would run from the bottom to the top. This is also referred to as an anti-parallel.
All right, now the rungs of this ladder are composed of two parts. It would be like making the ladder rungs out of two pieces of wood connected together in the middle. Now these sections of rungs are made up of variations of four different chemical bases. These bases are known as adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. Now on a DNA diagram, these bases are abbreviated as A, G, C, and T. Now if you were to build a ladder, if you were a ladder builder, your blueprints for constructing your ladders would instruct you to match up the two part rungs in specific patterns. And what I mean by that is, as you began to build a particular ladder rung, your blueprints would tell you that you can only match up the A half of a rung with a T half of a rung. And you must do this every time. There are specific guidelines for how these match up. Now, but your blueprints also instruct you that if you are building a rung using a C half, that you can only use the G half to match it with. So your ladder rungs are all either combinations of A's and T's or C's and G's. You can never have a rung combination in any other makeup. Now, you may find this a little bit interesting. There are 3 billion, and I say that with a B, that's a billion, base pairs in each cell. How many cells did I say we had? 37 trillion. Now let that sink in. 3 billion base pairs in each and every cell. Now these 3 billion pairs of bases fit into a space inside the cell that is just 6 microns across. If you were to stretch out the DNA in one cell, it would be about 6.5 feet in length. If you were to take all of the DNA in your cells, in your entire body, stretch them out end to end, it would stretch to Pluto and back to Earth. I am not kidding. Okay, let's discuss now how DNA replicates or copies itself. When our cells divide, it is vital that our DNA does the same. When a cell divides, the cell's DNA double helix also divides. It divides down the middle. When we discussed how the rungs of a ladder were constructed, remember we said that each rung was made up of 2 different parts. Well, when the DNA divides, it splits right down the middle of the middle of those rungs. For instance, if you had a ladder standing up against the wall, and you took a saw, starting at the top of the ladder, and cut down the middle of all the rungs of the ladder, your ladder would be cut in half with a left half and a right half. You would have a side rail with half of the rungs on your left, and a side rail with half of the rungs on your right. This is how DNA divides. If you will also remember, we discussed that if you had one half of a rung that was made of an A, or adenine, then the other half of the rung had to be a T, or thymine. Now this holds true after the DNA splits. Alright, now once the cell splits, the DNA must replicate, and it must replicate the missing sides. This replication is of vital importance. If the DNA is copied incorrectly, and sometimes that happens, then the cell has mixed up instructions, and the cell can grow in a haphazard fashion and can grow out of control. Now, this is quite often how cancerous cells begin. All right, now when the strand begins to replicate, it does so and matches the missing rung halves as they were prior to the cell split. In other words, all bases are matched with their required missing half. Adenine is matched with thymine, and cytosine is matched with guanine. All right, this is going to be a good spot for us to stop just for a moment. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come right back.
lied to, right? It's not if you're lied to, it's do you know when it happens? Studies show that the average person can only catch a lie about 54% of the time. Heck, you might as well just flip a coin. But studies also show that a person who has been properly trained in lie detection can detect lies about 90% of the time. A big difference. Stephen presented his How to Catch a Liar session at the 2018 Crime Con at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center and had to be moved from the Washington Conference Room into the Presidential Ballroom due to the enormous number of registrations to hear his program. Even in the Presidential Ballroom, it was standing room only with 850 people seated. You can have this session brought to your company or organization. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for more information.
Welcome back. Let's shift now in our discussion of DNA to DNA as evidence. Before the break, we discussed how DNA is composed of four nucleotides, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, and these pair together in certain order in the double DNA, in the DNA double helix. Now, in human cells, our DNA is wrapped into 23 pairs of chromosomes. Now, a chromosome is composed of tightly packed DNA that is wrapped many times around histones that act as a support or structure for the DNA. Now, a histone is a protein. Each chromosome has a centromere, which is a dividing point and divides the chromosome into two sections called arms. The location of the centromere can be helpful in describing the location of certain genes. Now, most DNA is the same from person to person, and in fact, 99.9% of your DNA is the same as everybody else's DNA across the world. Now, regarding evidence, the 0.1% is what is important here. Now, on a side note, you may find this amusing. Humans share 50% of our DNA with bananas. All right, I thought you might like that. Now, that getting back to what we're talking about, that 0.1% represents approximately 3 million pairs of bases. Now, DNA is often left behind on crime scenes, often unknowingly by the offender. DNA can be obtained from such biological material as hair, dandruff, mucus, earwax, and of course the common blood, semen, and sweat. And it usually only takes a very small sample to get an adequate DNA result. In the field, investigators will place the biological evidence in paper bags because of moisture. Biological evidence that is collected and placed in plastic evidence containers can be ruined by the moisture. This evidence is also kept out of heat and direct sunlight. Once the DNA has left the crime scene, it is then destined for the property room and then the forensics lab. Sometimes it goes directly to forensics. It just depends. Some forensics labs still utilize what is known as restriction fragment length polymorphism. Whew, wow, that's a mouthful, right? It's actually abbreviated RFLP. The RFLP process requires a larger sample of DNA, and this process analyzes DNA strand lengths that include base pair repetition, and this requires that the DNA be in an enzyme that causes the DNA to separate at certain points along the DNA strand. Each time this process is repeated, it alters the length of the strand. The RFLP is being replaced by a more modern and efficient analysis method called the short tandem repeat analysis, or the STR. With this process, a much smaller sample of DNA is required because a forensics lab can use what is called polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, to copy the DNA within a cell. Now, the lab can replicate this an almost endless number of times. In this process, it is ascertained how often the base pairs repeat in specific locations along a strand of DNA. The FBI has identified 13 locations that they use to serve as their standard. Now, when needing to identify old DNA such as teeth from an old homicide, the STR or RFLP cannot be used, and then the mtDNA or mitochondrial DNA analysis is employed. This technique is very useful in cold cases. All right, now when there's a suspect, investigators can attempt to match the suspect DNA sample with the crime scene DNA. Doing so yields three potential results. The first result, exclusions where there is not a match. Two, inclusions where the suspect cannot be excluded. And three, inconclusive, where the results are uncertain. And this often occurs due to a very small DNA sample or samples that have deteriorated for whatever reason. All right, I hope you were able to take something away from this episode. I urge you to share this show on your social media, especially with your true crime fans, friends. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to review the unsolved missing persons case of the Lost Boys. Stephen, I want to invite you to check out my book, Outside Your Door. Outside Your Door is a collection of true crime stories taken right from my case files and experience as a former police officer and undercover SVU detective. Some of the stories include the homicide case on which we used NASA's assistance. It includes my arrest of the Claremont Killer, as well as the undercover operation that led to my arrest of a fugitive from justice on Canada's Most Wanted. Now, Outside Your Door is not just a collection of stories about criminals. It includes stories on humanity. Ember and Quinn Hammond, co-hosts of the podcast Fiercely Altered Perspective, say of Outside Your Door, "This book really gives you the inside scoop of what happens in the life of our police, the good, the bad, and the tragic. You will laugh, and you will definitely cry." Get your copy and let me know what you think. Available online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Books A Million. Jay Boyle, age 17. Chad Smith, 18. Robbie Rumbolt, 17. Michael Cummings, age 17. Danny Higgins, age 16. And Jamie Lefebvre, age 17. All students of a local high school. They left the spring break party in the late evening. It was cold, 35 degrees, partly cloudy. There was a northwest wind approximately 12 miles per hour in Pickering, Ontario. As they left, they told a friend that they were going to goof around on a boat. It is believed that they went to the beach looking for fun and excitement. It was 1:48 a.m. on that Saturday morning that a surveillance camera recorded three of the boys entering East Shore Marina located at 1295 Wharf Street. It was between 2:30 a.m. and 3 a.m. when some residents in the area heard the rumble of a motorboat on the lake in the area of Frenchman's Bay. Pickering is on the north margin of Lake Ontario and is approximately 15 miles northeast of Toronto. Due south, approximately 40 miles, is Niagara Falls. In the early morning hours, sometime later, two boats were reported as stolen from two different marinas. It is believed that these boys took the boats to have a little fun, but they have never been heard from since. Law enforcement in the area think that the boats that they took out into the bay capsized, and due to the cold temperatures, that they quickly were overcome by hypothermia. The police connected the missing boys with the missing boats and then began a massive search around 2 p.m. that Saturday. A Toronto Police Marine unit, a helicopter, a C-130 airplane, and the Coast Guard were activated for assistance. Hundreds of volunteers helped in the search, but they found little. They found no clothing, no boats, no bodies. The only thing that was found was a gas can that belonged to one of the missing boats. What happened that fateful morning? A big question is, why was no evidence found? Questions such as, was there foul play involved? Did they plan this in order to disappear? Were they murdered? What happened? The missing persons case of the lost boys has never been solved. Do you have information on this case? Do you know what happened? If you have any information, I would like to urge you to contact the Durham Police Department at area code 905-579-1520, or you can call and leave an anonymous tip to Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-FREE, 1-800-222-8477. Thank you.
You've been listening to Crime and Forensics with Stephen David Lampley, your crime and forensics source from coast to coast.